Let's say a person having a heart attack and needs $300,000 worth of care and may not have insurance, and the hospital is saying, hey, you don't have health insurance, we're not going to provide that care. Welcome to this week's episode of the Rowland Forward podcast.
I'm Dr. Alicia Rowland.
I'm Dr. Stephanie Rowland.
We are two practicing physicians
who also do research, and we're here trying to demystify health news, get into the policy with you, and try to provide some evidence in a time of what feels like so much confusion.
This week, we're specifically going to talk about EMTALA.
EMTALA stands for the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, and it's something that we referenced before in our March episode about Dr. Oz.
EMTALA has been in the news a bunch, and it's something that we both in our day-to-day jobs think about a lot, but let's rewind a little bit and talk about what is EMTALA and where does it come from? Rolling forward,
Dr. Sister Science Fact. So, Alicia, what is EMTALA and where does it come from? I mean, you set me up there. This one is for you.
So EMTALA, as Stephanie said, is the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. It was enacted in the 1980s as a response to a growing concern at the time of patient dumping. There's probably a nicer way of saying this.
In the 1980s, as healthcare is starting to get more expensive, procedures are getting more expensive, there's fancier tests and everything, there was a concern that hospitals weren't taking care of people because of a mismatch with their insurance and reimbursement.
Prior to EMTALA, hospitals were refusing to treat patients that were uninsured or underinsured, or would just transfer them to other facilities, thinking that it wasn't profitable for them. At this time period, there are reports emerging that patients are dying after being turned away from emergency departments, and it leads to a lot of public outcry.
Let's say a person having a heart attack and needs $300,000 worth of care and may not have insurance, and the hospital saying, hey, you don't have health insurance, we're not going to provide that care. So EMTALA was introduced in 1986 as a response to this, saying that emergency department have a responsibility to stabilize patients.
It's a way to ensure public access to emergency services, regardless of a patient's ability to pay, but it actually only applies to hospitals that participate in Medicare.
So it's only Medicare participating hospitals, including the hospitals that we work at. So EMTALA is part of our daily lives because both Alicia and I work in the emergency department almost every shift that we're in the hospital.
There are a couple key components of EMTALA. The first, there's a medical screening requirement. Every person who comes to the emergency department must receive an appropriate medical screening exam to determine if any emergency medical condition exists. So, for example, someone walks into the emergency department, whether or not they can pay for those services, whether or not it's the right emergency department. As a pediatric emergency doctor, sometimes adults walk in.
By Alicia's hospital, it is so easy to get lost and up in the kids section instead of the adult section.
There's a big sign that says deliveries, and they mean Amazon and not babies.
I would totally go the wrong direction.
Many people have made that mistake.
So somebody walks into your emergency department, maybe they're not in the right place. And it's not always an insurance issue. Like Alicia says, sometimes it's an age issue, an adult in a peds emergency department. But they ask for a medical screening. They ask for an assessment, and hospitals are obliged to provide a medical screening.
If during that medical screening, you find out that someone has an emergency medical condition, you are required to treat and stabilize that condition before discharge or transfer. So you can't be like, oh, this person is having a heart attack, send him across the street without doing anything about it.
Push him across the street, put him in the wheelchair and get them to the other emergency department, literally across the street where you work.
I literally have this discussion of like, can we put them in a wheelchair and wheel them across the street? And the answer is no.
No, because they are in your emergency department. And so now you have a responsibility to stabilize them before transferring them to any services. And that's the second key component of EMTALA.
The third point is transfer restrictions. You can only transfer someone to another facility if they're stabilized and if they're medically appropriate for the receiving facility.
Which is a common part of my job. I do a lot of emergency psychiatry work. People walk into a medical ER saying that they're having a psychiatric emergency. They need to have one, a medical screening for any emergencies they might be having. 2, medical stabilization of any medical symptoms they're having, like chest pain. And then 3, we need to deem that they're stable before we transfer them to a psychiatric specific facility that can provide a higher level of care for what their psychiatric needs are.
This is something that comes up day to day. Emergency departments are often transferring patients to other emergency departments, to other facilities. And so it's something that we're talking about on the regular. Like EMTALA is something that I bring up maybe once a week, once every 2 weeks at work. Like it's something that we talk about regularly. Is this patient medically stable? Are they medically appropriate for transfer?
So Lisa, I've got a quick EMTALA quiz. Okay, you ready?
Let's do this.
You're a peds ER doctor working at a pediatric only hospital.
Yes.
Adult comes in with a gunshot wound. What do you do?
You have to do an emergency head-to-toe exam for emergency medical conditions, and you have to stabilize them.
How about an adult woman?
So that gets confusing. I mean, it gets complicated because, like, what is stabilization? Like, do they have to go to the operating room at the children's hospital? Do they not have to go to the operating room? When can they transfer? It gets really confusing.
I was just suspecting a stabilize them. Stabilize them. Okay. Adult woman comes in labor. Baby literally crowding.
As a non-OB provider, I had to learn about the stages of labor because once you reach a certain stage of labor and you're in active delivery, you can no longer stabilize them without having the baby. You can't transfer someone who's crowning. And so we have to practice, all emergency providers have to practice delivering babies, because if someone's coming in crowning, the stabilization means the baby's happening in your emergency department before they're transferred. My nightmare. My literal nightmare.
How about a kid comes in with a seizure, but he's uninsured?
You have to stabilize them. You have to provide them care.
Because your hospital can provide that level of care, and you should, and you will, regardless of their insurance.
Regardless of their insurance status.
So the point of this, it was supposed to be a pop quiz, didn't go quite as pop. But the point of this is, no matter who comes in, you stabilize them.
Did I pass?
You were so close to passing. No matter who comes in, you
examine and stabilize prior to determining if they're medically appropriate for transfer.
Perfect. And I do exactly the same thing working with adults, but often in psych only settings, because that's where I work. So we are constantly doing this as a part of our work. And so it was a little surprising to me when about 3-4 years ago, EMTALA became a part of conversation in America.
It became hot news. Is hot news a saying? I think I made it up. Hot off the press?
It became distressing news, discouraging news, upsetting news.
I mean, it was wild to me, this thing that I talk, this like obscure law that we talk about all the time of like, does this one little thing that we do, is would this be a violation of EMTALA, becomes part of the day-to-day conversation in Congress.
All of a sudden, my parents, who are not physicians, are asking me, what is EMTALA? And I'm like, wait, how have you even heard that? And the reason that it became a part of the national conversation around healthcare is because of the Dobbs decision. So in June of 2022, the Supreme Court decided in the Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization decision to effectively overturn the Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, which were these landmark cases that established a constitutional right to abortion in America.
Summary statement, Dobbs versus Jackson removed the constitutional protection around abortion access in the United States.
And so this introduced new restrictions in America around termination of pregnancy.
This transferred the decision about elective termination to the states.
So now we have a patchwork of 50 different states in each territory deciding how they're going to approach abortion, and physicians in different states are grappling with these new restrictions.
But I thought we were talking about EMTALA and the emergency department.
That's right. So you want to tell me how this applies?
So surprisingly, EMTALA became really hot when we're talking about abortion, because there are situations where abortions can be life-saving.
Newsflash, pregnancy is not safe. Pregnancy carries a lot of health risks. So shortly after the Dobbs decision, in June of 2022, CMS, or the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, provided guidance around EMTALA with respect to patients who were pregnant or experiencing pregnancy loss. And this guidance said that emergency departments must provide abortion services as part of stabilizing care in order to save people's lives, even in states with abortion bans.
They essentially emphasized and made it clear that a doctor's medical judgment and not a state law dictates what is necessary stabilization, even if that includes abortion care in a state where that would have been banned otherwise.
So any situation in which a pregnant person's life was threatened because of continuing a pregnancy.
This really came up in 2023, where there was a patient that was 18 weeks pregnant. They had a condition called preterm premature rupture of membranes. It is a life-threatening condition. This patient visited two facilities, one in Missouri, one in Kansas, and they refused to provide an abortion, even though it was medically necessary to prevent hemorrhage, really bad infection, possible death of the pregnant patient.
And that's why the Semtala guidance was put out shortly after the Dobbs decision, in order to provide protection for physicians and hospitals who are trying to stabilize and are trying to save lives. But the reality is that it hasn't been enough. Like with the case that you just mentioned, there's been a whole series of reporting done, including by ProPublica, looking at states with abortion bans and finding that women are dying of preventable pregnancy complications because they're not being offered life-saving elective terminations. So this guidance from CMS that was issued in July of 2022 is intended to provide some protection and some guidance for physicians and hospitals. And yet we know that it isn't enough because pregnant people are still dying. So CMS, or the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, enforces the EMTALA. And we spoke about this during our episode in March about Dr. Oz, that during his confirmation hearings, Dr. Oz didn't seem to understand that CMS was going to play a pivotal role in enforcing EMTALA.
So following this specific case and similar cases like this, there have been many cases in the news of violations of EMTALA where it is clear that hospitals are not offering what has been deemed medically necessary for stabilization under the Biden administration. And so the question comes of who enforces this law and what does enforcement look like?
Honestly, Alicia, that's never something I really thought about. I always make sure that I follow it very carefully. But what does enforcement look like?
So enforcement actually comes from the CMS, the Center for Medicaid and Medicaid Services. They investigate complaints that can be filed by individuals, by institutions, by patients, by staff. And ultimately, they can terminate a hospital's Medicare funding, which would be devastating.
Wow. This guidance sounds like it's something hospitals need to take seriously.
It also can lead to monetary penalties from the Office of the Inspector General, which can essentially fine hospitals and physicians specifically who violate EMTALA. So you can get financial penalties, and in some serious cases, you can have removal of Medicare funding, which funds a large portion of the U.S. healthcare budget.
And yet, there's been concerns that hospitals aren't following this guidance and that there's been this increase in maternal deaths in the United States following the overturn of Dobbs. And ProPublica has done some great reporting in this area, showing that there's been a significant increase in the number of women with sepsis or infection after a near total abortion ban in Texas. And so in many ways, this July 2022 guidance from the Biden administration has been the only thing protecting physicians, protecting hospitals when they've been trying to save people's lives, which makes the recent news about EMTALA all that much more concerning.
So what has been in the recent news?
The recent news has been that the Trump administration has rescinded the guidance from July of 2022, which required hospital emergency departments to provide abortion services as stabilizing care, even if it was in a state with an abortion ban. And what that means is that there's fear among physicians and there's fear among hospitals that are located in states with abortion bans that they can no longer provide abortion services in order to save a pregnant person's life.
Dr. Oz tweeted, and the administration has been using the words, quote, to clear up confusion. They're trying to clear up confusion that was left by the Biden administration, which feels disgusting.
Because there was not confusion. This was one of the only things that was making it clear that hospitals and physicians needed to act to save a person's life. And despite this guidance, we're still seeing an increase in maternal deaths in America. And so removing this guidance is only going to make it harder for physicians and hospitals to feel like they have the authority to act to save a pregnant person's life.
I think it's going to be super confusing as every state has different policies. Some providers practice in multiple states. It's going to be really confusing, the nuances of what can and cannot be provided depending on where you are. And we don't really know how much CMS is going to enforce these new guidelines and what that will look like.
And because also, if physicians provide an abortion in order to save someone's life, they are facing criminal charges. They are facing very serious personal consequences in these states with near total abortion bans. And so it becomes a question of not, oh, there'll be a financial penalty, or, oh, my hospital may be fined. It becomes a question of, oh, me as a physician, if I do this, I may face jail time. I may lose my license. I may lose my practice. I may lose my home. And those are some very scary consequences that physicians who are just trying to save their patients' lives, who are just trying to stabilize people who are having a medical emergency, now all of a sudden, it's a real Game of Thrones for them.
And we're seeing that in practice, in the sense that in states that have stricter abortion laws have fewer practicing OBGYNs, and that those physicians are more likely to report desire to relocate, moral distress, burnout, fear of prosecution.
And I'm hearing among my friends who are emergency medicine doctors or OBGYNs in states that have restrictions on abortions that they are scared that this July 2022 guidance was something that was providing them some comfort, some direction, some protection. And since that's been rescinded, they are scared. They are scared to do their jobs, and they are scared to keep living where they're living. And so I'm concerned that the downstream impacts of this are going to keep cascading.
I didn't know this. Residency applicants to OBGYN programs decreased by nearly 7% in states with bans. Medical students are actively avoiding attending schools in restrictive states to ensure comprehensive training. I mean, when I was applying for a fellowship, this was something that I was taking into account. I'm someone who does work in the reproductive health space. I do research in the reproductive health space. And I very specifically didn't rank Texas programs, knowing that my research probably wouldn't go forward the way that it does in other places. Like, this is something that I'm considering day to day. When I was interviewing for jobs, one of the things I was talking about was what happens if I'm arrested and who will bail me out of jail and what does that mean for my job at the institution? Like, these are serious concerns that people are having.
First, I will bail you out.
The hospital will bail me out. I had discussions.
But I will always be here for that. But it's scary because we're not talking about civil penalties that physicians are facing. We're talking about criminal penalties that physicians are being threatened with for doing their jobs. And so that is having a very real impact on the medical field. And we are seeing maternal mortality increase in this country. And with the rescinding of this guidance, I fear that that is only going to increase. And I fear what care people will have access to in an emergency, because these states with near total abortion bans, physicians are deciding between whether they will face a personal criminal penalty or if they're going to be able to provide care to save someone's life. And that's never a position that anyone should be in. And it's so sad that this is the reality in America in 2025.
I can't imagine, as an emergency medicine provider, I can't imagine ever being in that situation.
Because we're trained to first do no harm. And that's the mentality that we have. And that's the mindset that we go into. But we're also humans with families and with lives, and that we want to be able to go home at the end of our shift. And these are very real and very scary penalties that people are being threatened with.
You're making these decisions of, do I save this one person's life at the cost of going to jail, going to prison, not being able to spend time with my family, all the future patients that you're not able to treat because you treated this one patient.
Losing your medical license, losing your ability to work in healthcare, this career that you've worked for. And so I think I've just felt that the rescinding of this July 2022 guidance has been a real chilling effect and has really introduced a seriousness to some of the changes that we're seeing under this administration.
Yeah, I don't even know what to say that.
Neither Alicia nor I are practicing in states that have near total abortion bans or anything close to it. And
that's a very conscious choice for me.
As for me, to seek out a place that is welcoming to physicians, that is allowing us to practice the range of services that we feel we need to provide. But it's something that we are keeping a very close eye on, because who knows where this could spread to.
And on that happy note,
we need to get like some better health updates soon. Like, has anything good happened?
We need to end every episode with like, this fun thing happened this week.
I went to the DC Zoo recently and the baby pandas were playing. And
have you
so met? Cute.
Have you seen the new DC?
I have seen the new baby pandas. They're so cute.
I haven't seen the new panda.
They're so cute. You must go. You must go. Right after this, we'll go. I think we needed to cheer ourselves up. So everyone, go see your baby pandas.
I love how living in DC, one of the concerns about the like possible furlough last fall was that it might interrupt Pandapalooza.
Oh, we must have Pandapalooza, especially right now. I don't know what would happen to mental health without Pandapalooza.
And so, thankfully, we avoided the furlough, so Pandapalooza was not canceled.
Thank you for tuning in this week. I'm Dr. Stephanie Rowland.
I'm Dr. Alicia Rowland.
You can find us on social media as the Rowland Forward Podcast.
And you can always send us an email at Rowland Forward Show. That's R-O-L-I-N Forward Show at gmail.com.
We love to hear from all of you. And tune in next week where we'll be back with some positive health news updates.
Lies.
I mean,
that might be the first lie that we've said.
We will try to be back next week with some positive health news updates, but we'll do our best. I'm not controlling the news cycle here. It's just happening to me as it's happening to everyone else.
I heard it for the first time when it came out of my mouth.